Look, it wasn't 2 years, she said. It was 5.
Why so sure?
Because last time, I came to their house after a meeting at Windows on the World. It took Benny a minute to comprehend this.
Whoa,
he finally said.
How close to
4 days?
Wow, I never knew that.
He waited out a respectful pause, then continued.
Still, 2 years, 5 years.
Sasha turned and stared at him. She looked angry.
Who am I talking to? She asked.
You're Benny Salazar. This is the music business. 5 years is 500 years. Your words. Benny didn't answer. They were approaching his former house, as he thought of it.
He couldn't say old house, but he also couldn't say house anymore, although he'd certainly paid for it.
His former house was withdrawn from the street on a grassy slope, a gleaming white colonial that had filled him with awe every time he'd taken a key from his pocket to open the front door. Benny stopped at the curb and killed the engine. He couldn't bring himself to drive up the driveway. Chris was leaning forward from the back seat, his head between Benny and Sasha. Benny wasn't sure how long he'd been there.
I think you need some of your medicine, Dad, he said.
Good idea, Benny said.
He began tapping his pockets, but the little red box was nowhere to be found.
Here, I've got it, Sasha said. You dropped it coming out of the recording room.
She was doing that more and more, finding things he'd misplaced, sometimes before Benny even knew they were missing. It added to the almost trance-like dependence he felt on her.
Thanks, Sash, he said.
He opened the box. God, the flakes were shiny. Gold didn't tarnish, that was the thing. The flakes would look the same in 5 years as they did right now.
Should I put some on my tongue like you did?
He asked his son.
Yeah, but I get some too.
Sasha, you want to try a little medicine? Benny asked.
Okay, she said. What's it supposed to do?
Solve your problems,
Benny said.
I mean, headaches. Not that you have any.
Never, Sasha said, with that same wary smile. They each took a pinch of gold flakes and placed them on their tongues. Benny tried not to calculate the dollar value of what was inside their mouths. He concentrated on the taste. Was it metallic, or was that just his expectation? Coffee, or was that what was left in his mouth? He tongued the gold in a tight knot and sucked the juice from within it. Sour, he thought. Bitter. Sweet? Each one seemed true for a second, but in the end, Benny had an impression of something mineral, like stone, even earth, and then the lump melted away.
I should go, Dad, Chris said.
Benny let him out of the car and hugged him hard. As always, Chris went still in his embrace, but whether he was savoring it or enduring it, Benny could never tell. He drew back and looked at his son. The baby he and Stephanie had nuzzled and kissed, now this painful, mysterious presence. Benny was tempted to say,
"Don't tell your mother about the medicine,"
craving an instant of connection with Chris before he went inside. But he hesitated, employing a mental calculation Dr. Beat had taught him. Did he really think the kid would tell Stephanie about the gold?
No.
And that was his alert.
Betrayal bonding.
Benny said nothing. He got back in the car, but didn't turn the key. He was watching Chris scale the undulating lawn toward his former house. The grass was fluorescently bright. His son seemed to buckle under his enormous backpack. What the hell was in it? Benny had seen professional photographers carry less. As Chris neared the house, he blurred a little. Or maybe it was Benny's eyes watering. He found it excruciating, watching his son's long journey to the front door. He worried Sasha would speak, say something like,
"He's a great kid," or, "That was fun,"
something that would require Benny to turn and look at her. But Sasha knew better.
She knew everything. She sat with Benny in silence, watching Chris climb the fat, bright grass to the white front door, then open it without turning and go inside. They didn't speak again until they'd passed from the Henry Hudson Parkway onto the West Side Highway, heading into Lower Manhattan. Benny played some early Who, the Stooges, bands he'd listened to before he was even old enough to go to a concert. Then he got into Flipper, the Mutants, Eye Protection, 70s Bay Area groups he and his gang had slam danced to at the Mabuhay High Gardens when they weren't practicing with their own unlistenable band, the Flaming Dildos. He sensed Sasha paying attention and toyed with the idea that he was confessing to her his disillusionment, his hatred for the industry he'd given his life to. He began weighing each musical choice, drawing out his argument through the songs themselves, Patti Smith's ragged poetry. But why did she quit? The jock hardcore of Black Flag and the Circle Jerks giving way to Alternative, that great compromise, down, down, down to the singles he'd just today been petitioning radio stations to add, husks of music, lifeless and cold as the squares of office neon cutting the blue twilight. "It's incredible," Sasha said, "how there's just nothing there." Astounded, Benny turned to her. Was it possible that she'd followed his musical rant to its grim conclusion? Sasha was looking downtown, and he followed her eyes to the empty space where the Twin Towers had been. "There should be something, you know," she said, not looking at Benny. "Like an echo, or an outline." Benny sighed.
"They'll put something up," he said, "when they're finally done squabbling."
"I know." But she kept looking south, as if it were a problem her mind couldn't solve. Benny was relieved she hadn't understood. He remembered his mentor, Lou Klein, telling him in the 90s that rock and roll had peaked at Monterey Pop. They'd been in Lou's house in L.A., with its waterfalls, the pretty girls Lou always had, his car collection out front, and Benny had looked into his idol's famous face and thought, "You're finished." Nostalgia was the end. Everyone knew that. Lou had died 3 months ago, after years of being paralyzed from a stroke. At a stoplight, Benny remembered his list. He took out the parking ticket and finished it off. "What do you keep scribbling on that ticket?" Sasha asked. Benny handed it to her, his reluctance to have the list seen by human eyes overwhelming him a half second late. To his horror, she began reading it aloud. "Kissing Mother Superior, incompetent, hairball, poppy seeds, on the can." Benny listened in agony, as if the words themselves might provoke a catastrophe. But they were neutralized the instant Sasha spoke them in her scratchy voice. "Not bad," she said. "They're titles, right?"
"Sure," Benny said. "Can you read them one more time?"
She did, and now they sounded like titles to him, too. He felt peaceful, cleansed. "Kissing Mother Superior is my favorite," Sasha said. "We've got to find a way to use that one." They'd pulled up outside her building on Forsyth. The street felt desolate and underlit. Benny wished she could live in a better place. Sasha gathered up her ubiquitous black bag, a shapeless wishing well from which she'd managed to wrest whatever file or number or slip of paper he'd needed for the past 12 years. Benny seized her thin white hand.
"Listen," he said. "Listen, Sasha."
She looked up. Benny felt no lust at all. He wasn't even hard. What he felt for Sasha was love, a safety and closeness, like what he'd had with Stephanie before he'd let her down so many times that she couldn't stop being mad.
"I'm crazy for you, Sasha," he said. "Crazy."
"Come on, Benny," Sasha chided lightly. "None of that." He held her hand between both of his. Sasha's fingers were trembly and cold. Her other hand was on the door. Wait, Benny said. Please?
She turned to him, somber now. There's no way, Benny, she said. We need each other. They looked at one another in the failing light. The delicate bones of Sasha's face were lightly freckled. It was a girl's face, but she'd stopped being a girl when he wasn't looking. Sasha leaned over and kissed Benny's cheek. A chaste kiss. A kiss between brother and sister, mother and son. But Benny felt the softness of her skin. The warm movement of her breath. Then she was out of the car. She waved to him through the window and said something he didn't catch. Benny lunged across the empty seat, his face near the glass, staring fixedly as she said it again. Still, he missed it. As he struggled to open the door, Sasha said it once more, mouthing the words extra slowly. See you tomorrow. Chapter 3. Ask Me If I Care. Late at night, when there's nowhere left to go, we go to Alice's house. Scotty drives his pickup, two of us squeezed in front with him, blasting bootleg tapes of The Stranglers, The Nuns, Negative Trend, the other two stuck in back where you freeze all year long, getting tossed in the actual air when Scotty crests the hills. Still, if it's Benny and me, I hope for the back, so I can push against his shoulder in the cold and hold him for a second when we hit a bump. The first time we went to Seacliff, where Alice lives, she pointed up a hill at fog sneaking through the eucalyptus trees and said her old school was up there, an all-girls school where her little sisters go now. K through 6, you wear a green plaid jumper and brown shoes. After that, a blue skirt and white sailor top. And you can pick your own shoes. Scotty goes, "Can we see them?" And Alice goes, "My uniforms?" But Scotty goes, "No, your alleged sisters." She leads the way upstairs, Scotty and Benny right behind her. They're both fascinated by Alice, but it's Benny who entirely loves her. And Alice loves Scotty, of course. Benny's shoes are off, and I watch his brown heels sink into the white cotton candy carpet, so thick it muffles every trace of us. Jocelyn and I come last. She leans close to me, and inside her whisper, I smell cherry gum covering up the 500 cigarettes we've smoked. I can't smell the gin we drank at the beginning of the night, pouring it into Coke cans from my dad's hidden supply so we can drink it on the street. Jocelyn goes, "Watch Rhea. They'll be blonde, her sisters." I go, "According to..." "Rich children are always blonde," Jocelyn goes. "It has to do with vitamins." Believe me, I don't mistake that for information. I know everyone Jocelyn knows. The room is dark, except for a pink nightlight. I stop in the doorway and Benny hangs back too, but the other three go crowding into the space between the beds. Alice's little sisters are sleeping on their sides, covers tucked around their shoulders. One looks like Alice, with pale wavy hair. The other is dark, like Jocelyn. I'm afraid they'll wake up and be scared of us in our dog collars and safety pins and shredded t-shirts. I think we shouldn't be here. Scotty shouldn't have asked to come in. Alice shouldn't have said yes, except she says yes to everything Scotty asks. I think I want to lie down in one of those beds and go to sleep. Ahem, I whisper to Jocelyn as we're leaving the room. Dark hair. She whispers back. Black sheep. 1980 is almost here. Thank God. The hippies are getting old. They blew their brains on acid, and now they're begging on street corners all over San Francisco. Their eyes are sunburned, and their hair is tangled, and their bare feet are thick and gray as shoes. We're sick of them. At school, we spend every free minute in the pit. It's not a pit in the strictly speaking sense. It's a strip of pavement above the playing fields. We inherited it from last year's pitters who graduated,
but still we get nervous walking in if other pitters are already there. Tatum, who wears a different colored danskin every day, or Wayne, who grows sinsemilla in his actual closet, or Boomer, who's always hugging everyone since his family did est. I'm nervous walking in, unless Jocelyn is already there, or, for her, me. We stand in for each other. On warm days, Scotty plays his guitar. Not the electric he uses for Flaming Dildos gigs, but a lap steel guitar that you hold a different way. Scotty actually built this instrument, bent the wood, glued it, painted on the shellac. Everyone gathers around. There's no way not to when Scotty plays. One time, an entire soccer team climbed up from the athletic field to listen, looking around in their jerseys and long red socks like they didn't know how they got there. Scotty is magnetic. And I say this as someone who does not love him. The Flaming Dildos have had a lot of names. The Crabs, the Crocs, the Crimps, the Crunch, the Scrunch, the Gawks, the Gobs, the Flaming Spiders, the Black Widows. Every time Scotty and Benny change it, Scotty sprays black over his guitar case and Benny's bass case, and then he makes a stencil of the new name and sprays it on. We don't know how they decide if they should keep a name, because Benny and Scotty don't actually talk. But they agree on everything, maybe through ESP. Jocelyn and I write all the lyrics and work out the tunes with Benny and Scotty. We sing with them in rehearsal, but we don't like being on stage. Alice doesn't either. The only thing we have in common with her. Benny transferred last year from a high school in Daly City. We don't know where he lives, but some days we visit him after school at Green Apple Records on Clement, where he works. If Alice comes with us, Benny will take his break and share a pork bun in the Chinese bakery next door while the fog gallops past the windows. Benny has light brown skin and excellent eyes, and he irons his hair in a mohawk as shiny black as a virgin record. He's usually looking at Alice, so I can watch him as much as I want. Down the path from the pit is where the Cholos hang out, with their black leather coats and clicky shoes and dark hair in almost invisible nets. Sometimes they talk to Benny in Spanish, and he smiles at them but never answers. Why do they keep speaking Spanish to him? I go to Jocelyn, and she looks at me and goes, "Rhea, Benny's a Cholo, isn't that obvious?" "That's factually crazy," I go, and my face is getting hot. "He has a mohawk, and he's not even friends with them." Jocelyn goes, "Not all Cholos are friends." Then she says, "The good news is, rich girls won't go with Cholos, so he'll never get Alice. Period. The end." Jocelyn knows I'm waiting for Benny, but Benny is waiting for Alice, who's waiting for Scotty, who's waiting for Jocelyn, who's known Scotty the longest and makes him feel safe, I think, because even though Scotty is magnetic, with bleached hair and a studly chest that he likes to uncover when it's sunny out, his mother died 3 years ago from sleeping pills. Scotty's been quieter since then, and in cold weather, he shivers like someone is shaking him. Jocelyn loves Scotty back, but she isn't in love with him. Jocelyn is waiting for Lou, an adult man who picked her up hitchhiking. Lou lives in L.A., but he said he would call the next time he comes to San Francisco. That was weeks ago. No one is waiting for me. In this story, I'm the girl no one is waiting for. Usually the girl is fat, but my problem is more rare, which is freckles. I look like someone threw handfuls of mud at my face. When I was little, my mom told me they were special. Thank God I'll be able to remove them when I'm old enough and can pay for it myself. Until that time, I have my dog collar and green rinse, because how can anyone call me the girl with freckles when my hair is green? Jocelyn has chopped black hair that looks permanently wet, and 12 ear piercings that I gave her with a pointed earring, not using ice. She has a beautiful half-Chinese face. It makes a difference.
I've done everything with Jocelyn since fourth grade. Hopscotch, jump rope, charm bracelets, buried treasure, Harriet the spying, blood sisters, crank calls, pot, coke, quaaludes. She's seen my dad puking into the hedge outside our building, and I was with her on Polk Street the night she recognized one of the leather boys hugging outside the White Swallow, and it was her dad, who was on a business trip before he moved away. So I still can't believe I missed the day she met the man, Lou. She was hitchhiking home from downtown, and he pulled up in a red Mercedes and drove her to an apartment he uses on his trips to San Francisco. He unscrewed the bottom of a can of Right Guard, and a baggie of cocaine dropped out. Lou did some lines off Jocelyn's bare butt, and they went all the way twice, not including when she went down on him. I made Jocelyn repeat each detail of this story until I knew everything she knew, so we could be equal again. Lou is a music producer who knows Bill Graham personally. There were gold and silver record albums on his walls, and 1,000 electric guitars. The Flaming Dildos rehearsal is on Saturday, in Scotty's garage. When Jocelyn and I get there, Alice is setting up the new tape recorder her stepfather bought her, with a real microphone. She's one of those girls that likes machines, another reason for Benny to love her. Joel, the dildo's steady drummer, comes next, driven by his dad, who waits outside in his station wagon for the whole practice, reading World War II books. Joel is AP everything, and he's applied to Harvard, so I guess his dad isn't taking any chances. Where we live, in the sunset, the ocean is always just over your shoulder, and the houses have Easter egg colors. But the second Scotty lets the garage door slam down, we're suddenly enraged, all of us. Benny's bass snickers to life, and pretty soon we're screaming out the songs which have titles like Pet Rock and Do the Math and Pass Me the Kool-Aid. But when we holler them aloud in Scotty's garage, the lyrics might as well be fuck, 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 fuck. Every once in a while, a kid from band and orchestra pounds on the garage door to try out, invited by Benny. And every time Scotty ropes up the door, we glare out at the bright day, shaking its head at us. Today we try a sax, a tuba, and a banjo. But sax and banjo keep hogging the stage, and tuba covers her ears as soon as we start to play. Practice is almost over when there's another banging on the garage door, and Scotty pulls it up. An enormous, pimpled kid in an AC/DC t-shirt is standing there, holding a violin case. He goes,
I'm looking for Benny Salazar.
Jocelyn and Alice and I stare at one another in shock, which feels for a second like we're all three friends, like Alice is part of us.
Hey, guy, Benny says. Good timing. Everybody, this is Marty.
Even smiling, there's no hope for Marty's face. But I'm worried he might think the same of me, so I don't smile back. Marty plugs in his violin, and we launch into our best song, What the Fuck. You said you were a fairy princess. You said you were a shooting star. You said we'd go to Bora Bora. Now look at where the fuck we are. Bora Bora was Alice's idea. We'd never heard of it. While everyone howls out the chorus, what the fuck, what the fuck, what the fuck, I watch Benny, listen, eyes closed, his mohawk like 1,000 antennas pricking up from his head. When the song ends, he opens his eyes and grins.
I hope you got that, Al, he goes,
and Alice rewinds the tape to make sure. Alice takes all our tapes and turns them into one top tape. And Benny and Scotty drive from club to club, trying to get people to book the Flaming Dildos for a gig. Our big hope is the MAB, of course. The Mabuhay Gardens on Broadway, where all the punk bands play. Scotty waits in the truck while Benny deals with the rude assholes inside the clubs. We have to be careful with Scotty. In fifth grade, the first time his mom went away, he sat all day on the patch of grass outside his house and stared at the sun. He refused to go to school or come in. His dad sat with him trying to cover his eyes, and after school, Jocelyn came and sat there too. Now there are permanent gray smudges in Scotty's vision. He says he likes them. Actually, what he says is, "I consider them a visual enhancement." We think they remind him of his mom. We go to the MAB every Saturday night after practice. We've heard Crime, The Avengers, The Germs, and a trillion other bands. The bar is too expensive, so we drink from my dad's supply ahead of time. Jocelyn needs to drink more than me to get buzzed, and when she feels the booze hit, she takes a long breath, like finally she's herself again. In the MAB's graffiti-splattered bathroom, we eavesdrop. Ricky Sleeper fell off the stage at a gig. Joe Reese of Target Video is making an entire movie of punk rock. Two sisters we always see at the club have started turning tricks to pay for heroin. Knowing all this makes us one step closer to being real, but not completely. When does a fake mohawk become a real mohawk? Who decides? How do you know if it's happened? During the shows, we slam dance in front of the stage. We tussle and push and get knocked down and pulled back up until our sweat is mixed up with real punk sweat and our skin has touched their skin. Benny does less of this. I think he actually listens to the music. One thing I've noticed, no punk rockers have freckles. They don't exist. One night, Jocelyn answers her phone, and it's Lou going, "Hello, beautiful." "He's been calling for days and days," he goes, "but the phone just rings." "Why not try calling at night?" I ask when Jocelyn repeats this. That Saturday, after rehearsal, she goes out with Lou instead of us. We go to the MAB, then back to Alice's house. By now, we treat the place like we own it. We eat the yogurts her mom makes in glass cups on a warming machine. We lie on the living room couch with our sock feet on the armrests. One night, her mom made us hot chocolate and brought it into the living room on a gold tray. She had big, tired eyes and tendons moving in her neck. Jocelyn whispered in my ear, "Rich people like to hostess so they can show off their nice stuff." Tonight, without Jocelyn here, I ask Alice if she still has those school uniforms she mentioned long ago. She looks surprised. "Yeah," she goes, "I do." I follow her up the fluffy stairs to her actual room, which I've never seen. It's smaller than her sister's room, with blue shag carpeting and crisscross wallpaper in blue and white. Her bed is under a mountain of stuffed animals, which all turn out to be frogs. Bright green, light green, day glow green, some with stuffed flies attached to their tongues. Her bedside lamp is shaped like a frog, plus her pillow. I go, "I didn't know you were into frogs." And Alice goes, "How would you?" I haven't really been alone with Alice before. She seems not as nice as when Jocelyn is around. She opens her closet, stands on a chair, and pulls down a box with some uniforms inside. A green plaid one-piece from when she was little, a sailor suit two-piece from later on. I go, "Which did you like better?" "Neither," she goes. "Who wants to wear a uniform?" I go, "I would." "Is that a joke?" "What kind of joke would it be?" "The kind where you and Jocelyn laugh about how you made a joke and I didn't get it?" My throat turns very dry. I go, "I won't laugh with Jocelyn." Alice shrugs. "Ask me if I care," she goes. We sit on her rug, the uniforms across our knees. Alice wears ripped jeans and drippy black eye makeup, but her hair is long and gold. She isn't a real punk either. After a while, I go, "Why do your parents let us come here?" "They're not my parents. They're my mother and stepfather." "Okay." "They want to keep an eye on you, I guess." The foghorns are extra loud in Seacliff, like we're alone on a ship sailing through the thickest fog. I hug my knees, wishing so much that Jocelyn was with us. "Are they right now?" I go, softly. Keeping an eye? Alice takes a huge breath and lets it back out. No, she goes. They're asleep. Marty, the violinist, isn't even in high school. He's a sophomore at SF State, where Jocelyn and I, and Scotty, if he passes Algebra 2, are headed next year. Jocelyn goes to Benny. The shit will hit the fan if you put that dork on stage.
I guess we'll find out,
Benny goes, and he looks at his watch like he's thinking.
In 2 weeks and 4 days and 6 hours and I'm not sure how many minutes.
We stare at him, not comprehending. Then he tells us, Dirk Dirksen from the MAB gave him a call. Jocelyn and I shriek and hug onto Benny, which for me is like touching something electrical, his actual body in my arms. I remember every hug I've given him. I learn one thing each time, how warm his skin is, how he has muscles like Scotty, even though he never takes his shirt off. This time, I find his heartbeat, which pushes my hand through his back. Jocelyn goes, who else knows? Scotty, of course. Alice, too. But it's only later that this bothers us. I have cousins in Los Angeles, so Jocelyn calls Lou from our apartment, where the charge won't stand out on the phone bill. I'm 2 inches away on my parents' flowered bedspread while she dials the phone with a long black fingernail. I hear a man's voice answer, and it shocks me that he's real. Jocelyn didn't make him up, even though I never supposed such a thing. He doesn't go, hey, beautiful, though. He goes, I told you to let me call you. Jocelyn goes, sorry, in an empty little voice. I grab the phone and go, what kind of hello is that? Lou goes, who the Christ am I talking to? And I tell him, Rhea. Then he goes in a calmer voice, nice to meet you, Rhea. Now, would you hand the phone back to Jocelyn? This time she pulls the cord away. Lou seems to be doing most of the talking. After a minute or two, Jocelyn hisses at me, you have to leave, go. I walk out of my parents' bedroom into our yellow kitchen. There's a fern hanging from the ceiling by a chain, dropping little brown leaves in the sink. The curtains have a pineapple pattern. My two brothers are on the balcony, grafting bean plants for my little brother's science project. I go outside with them, the sun poking straight into my eyes. I try to force myself to look straight at it, like Scotty did. After a while, Jocelyn comes out. Happiness is floating up from her hair and skin. Ask me if I care, I think. Later she tells me Lou said yes, he'll come to the Dildos gig at the MAB, and maybe he'll give us a record contract. It's not a promise, he warned her, but we'll have a good time anyway, right, beautiful? Don't we always? The night of the concert, I come with Jocelyn to meet Lou for dinner at Vanessi's, a restaurant just down Broadway from the MAB, where tourists and rich people sit outside drinking Irish coffees and gawking at us when we walk by. We could have invited Alice, but Jocelyn goes, her parents probably take her to Vanessi's all the time. I go, you mean her mother and stepfather. A man is sitting in a round corner booth, smiling teeth at us, and that man is Lou. He looks as old as my dad, meaning 43. He has shaggy blonde hair, and his face is handsome, I guess, the way dads can sometimes be.
Come here, beautiful, Lou actually does say, and he lifts an arm to Jocelyn.
He's wearing a light blue denim shirt and some kind of copper bracelet. She slides around the side of the table and fits right under his arm.
Rhea,
Lou goes, and lifts up his other arm for me. So instead of sliding in next to Jocelyn, like I was just about to do, I end up on Lou's other side. His arm comes down around my shoulder. And like that, we're Lou's girls. A week ago, I looked at the menu outside Vanessi's and saw linguine with clams. All week long, I've been planning to order that dish. Jocelyn picks the same, and after we order, Lou hands her something under the table. We both slide out of the booth and go to the ladies' room. It's a tiny brown bottle full of cocaine. There's a miniature spoon attached to a chain, and Jocelyn heaps up the spoon 2 times for each nostril. She sniffs and makes a little sound and shuts her eyes. Then she fills the spoon again and holds it for me. By the time I walk back to the table, I've got eyes blinking all over my head, seeing everything in the restaurant at once. Maybe the Coke we did before wasn't really Coke. We sit down and tell Lou about a new band we've heard of called Flipper, and Lou tells us about being on a train in Africa that didn't completely stop at the stations. It just slowed down so people could jump off or on. I go, "I want to see Africa." And Lou goes, "Maybe we'll go together, the three of us." And it seems like this really might happen. He goes, "The soil in the hills is so fertile it's red." And I go, "My brothers are grafting bean plants, but the soil is just regular brown soil." And Jocelyn goes, "What about the mosquitoes?" And Lou goes, "I've never seen a blacker sky or a brighter moon." And I realize that I'm beginning my adult life right now, on this night. When the waiter brings my linguine and clams, I can't take one bite. Only Lou eats an almost raw steak, a Caesar salad, red wine. He's one of those people who never stops moving. 3 times people come to our table to say hello to Lou, but he doesn't introduce us. We talk and talk while our food gets cold, and when Lou finishes eating, we leave Vanessi's. On Broadway, he keeps an arm around each of us. We pass the usual things. The scuzzy guy in a fez trying to lure people inside the Casbah. The strippers lounging in doorways of the Condor and Big Al's. Punk rockers rove in laughing, shoving packs. Traffic pushes along Broadway, people honking and waving from their cars like we're all at one gigantic party. With my 1,000 eyes, it looks different, like I'm a different person seeing it. I think, after my freckles are gone, my whole life will be like this. The door guy at the MAB recognizes Lou and whisks us past the snaking line of people waiting for the Cramps and the Nuns, who are playing later on. Inside, Benny and Scotty and Joel are on stage setting up with Alice. She tests the equipment and adjusts the volume while Scotty tunes his guitar. Jocelyn and I put on our dog collars and safety pins in the bathroom. When we come back out, Lou's already introducing himself to the band. Benny shakes Lou's hand and goes, "It's an honor, sir." After the usual sarcastic introduction from Dirk Dirksen, the Flaming Dildos open with Snake in the Grass. No one is dancing, or even really listening. They're still coming into the club or standing around, killing time until the bands they came for start playing. Normally, Jocelyn and I would be directly in front of the stage, but tonight we stand in back, leaning against a wall with Lou. He's bought us both gin and tonics. I can't tell if the dildos sound good or bad. I can barely hear them. My heart is beating too hard and my 1,000 eyes are peering all over the room. I drink my gin and tonic fast. According to the muscles on the side of Lou's face, he's grinding his teeth. Marty comes on for the next number, but he spazzes out and drops his violin. The barely interested crowd gets just interested enough to yell some insults when he crouches to replug it with his plumber's crack displaying. I can't even look at Benny. It matters so much. When they start playing Do the Math, Lou yells in my ear, "Whose idea was the violin?" I go, "Benny's." "Kid on bass?" I nod, and Lou watches Benny for a minute, and I watch him too. Lou goes, "Not much of a player." "But he's," I try to explain, "the whole thing is his..." Something gets tossed at the stage that looks like glass, but when it hits Scotty's face, thank God it's only ice from a drink. Scotty flinches, but keeps on playing, and then a Budweiser can flies up and clips Marty right in the forehead. Jocelyn and I look at each other panicked, but when we try to move, Lou anchors us. The dildos start playing What the Fuck, but now garbage is spewing at the stage, chucked by four guys with safety pin chains connecting their nostrils to their earlobes. Alice physically shoves these guys, and they push her back, and I try for real to pull away so Benny will see that I'm helping, but Lou hugs me in place. Every few seconds, another drink strikes Scotty's face. Finally, he just plays with his eyes shut, and I wonder if he's seen the scar spots. Alice is trying to tackle the garbage throwers now, and suddenly, people are slam dancing hard, the kind of dancing that's basically fighting. Joel clobbers his drums as Scotty tears off his dripping t-shirt and snaps it at one of the garbage throwers, right in the guy's face with a twangy crack, and then at another one. Snrack! Like my brother's snapping bath towels, but sharper. The Scotty magnet is starting to work. People watch his bare muscles shining with sweat and beer. Then one of the garbage throwers tries to storm the stage, but Scotty kicks him in the chest with the flat of his boot. There's a kind of gasp from the crowd as the guy flies back. Scotty's smiling now, grinning like I almost never see him grin, wolf teeth flashing sharp on the sides of his mouth, and I realize that, out of all of us, Scotty is the truly angry one. I turn to Jocelyn, but she's gone. Maybe my thousand eyes are what tell me to look down. I see Lou's fingers spread out over her black hair. She's kneeling in front of him, giving him head, like the music is a disguise and no one can see them. Maybe no one does. Lou's other arm is around me, which I guess is why I don't run, although I could, that's the thing. But I stand there while Lou mashes Jocelyn's head against himself again and again, so I don't know how she can breathe, until it starts to seem like she's not even Jocelyn, but some kind of animal or machine that can't be broken. I force myself to look at the band, Scotty snapping the wet shirt at people's eyes and knocking them with his boot, Lou grasping my shoulder, squeezing it harder, turning his head to my neck and letting out a hot, stuttering groan I can hear even through the music. He's that close. A sob cracks open in me. Tears leak out from my eyes, but only the two in my face. The other thousand eyes are closed. The walls of Lou's apartment are covered with electric guitars and gold and silver record albums, just like Jocelyn said. But she never mentioned that it was on the 35th floor, 6 blocks away from the map, or the green marble slabs in the elevator. I think that was a lot to leave out. In the kitchen, Jocelyn pours Fritos into a dish and takes a glass bowl of green apples out of the refrigerator. She's already passed around Quaaludes, offering one to every person except me. I think she's afraid to look at me. Who's the hostess now? I want to ask. In the living room, Alice is sitting with Scotty, who wears a Pendleton shirt from Lou's closet and looks white and shaky, maybe from having stuff thrown at him, maybe because he understands for real that Jocelyn has a boyfriend and it isn't him and never will be. Marty is there too. He's got a cut on his cheek and an almost black eye, and he keeps going, "That was intense," to no one in particular. Joel got driven straight home, of course. Everyone agrees the gig went well. When Lou leads Benny up a curling staircase to his recording studio, I tag along. He calls Benny kiddo and explains each machine in the room, which is small and warm, with black foam points all over the walls. Lou's legs move restlessly, and he eats a green apple with loud cracks, like he's gnawing rock. Benny glances out the door toward the rail overlooking the living room, trying to get a glimpse of Alice. I keep being about to cry. I'm worried that what happened in the club counts as having sex with Lou, that I was part of it. Finally, I go back downstairs. Off the living room, I notice a door partly open, a big bed just beyond it. I go in and lie face down on a velvet bedspread. A peppery incense smell trickles up around me. The room is cool and dim, with pictures in frames on both sides of the bed, My whole body hurts. After a few minutes, someone comes in and lies down next to me, and I know it's Jocelyn. We don't say anything. We just lie there side by side in the dark. Finally, I go, "You should have told me."
"Told you what?"
she goes, "but I don't even know." Then she goes,
"There's too much."
And I feel like something is ending, right at that minute. After a while, Jocelyn turns on a lamp by the bed.
"Look," she goes.
She's holding a framed picture of Lou in a swimming pool, surrounded by kids. The two littlest ones, almost babies. I count 6. Jocelyn goes,
"There is children. That blonde girl, everyone calls her Charlie, she's 20. Rolf, that one, he's our age. They went to Africa with him."
I lean close to the picture. Lou looks so happy surrounded by his kids like any normal dad, to the point where I can't believe this Lou with us is the very same man. Then I notice his son Rolf. He has blue eyes and black hair and a bright, sweet smile. I get a crawling feeling in my stomach. I go, "Rolf is decent." And Jocelyn laughs and goes,
"Really?"
Then she goes,
"Don't tell Lou I said that."
He comes into the bedroom a minute later, rock crunching another apple. I realize the apples are completely for Lou. He eats them nonstop. I slide off the bed without looking at him, and he shuts the door behind me. It takes me a second to get what's going on in the living room. Scotty is sitting cross-legged, picking at a gold guitar in the shape of a flame. Alice is behind him, with her arms around his neck, her face next to his, her hair falling into his lap. Her eyes are closed with joy. I forget who I actually am for a second. All I can think is how Benny will feel when he sees this. I look around for him, but there's just Marty peering at the albums on the wall, trying to be inconspicuous. And then I notice the music flooding out of every part of the apartment at once, the couch, the walls, even the floor, and I know Benny's alone in Lou's studio, pouring music around us. A minute ago it was Don't Let Me Down. Then it was Blondie's Heart of Glass. Now it's Iggy Pop's The Passenger. I am the passenger, and I ride and I ride. I ride through the city's backside. I see the stars come out of the sky. Listening, I think, you will never know how much I understand you. I notice Marty looking over at me kind of hesitant, and I see how this is supposed to work. I'm the dog, so I get Marty. I slide open a glass door and go on to Lou's balcony. I've never seen San Francisco from so high up. It's a soft blue-black, with colored lights and fog like gray smoke. Long piers reach out into the flat, dark bay. There's a mean wind, so I run in for my jacket and then come back out and curl up tightly on a white plastic chair. I stare at that view until I start to get calm. I think, the world is actually huge. That's the part no one can really explain. After a while, the door slides open. I don't look up, thinking it's Marty, but it turns out to be Lou. He's barefoot, wearing shorts. His legs are tan even in the dark. I go, "Where's Jocelyn?"
"Asleep,"
Lou goes. He's standing at the railing, looking out. It's the first time I've seen him be still. I go, "Do you even remember being our age?" Lou grins at me in my chair, but it's a copy of last night's grin.
"I am your age,"
he goes.
"Ahem,"
I go. "You have 6 kids."
"So I do,"
he goes. He turns his back, waiting for me to disappear. I think, I didn't have sex with this man. I don't even know him. Then he goes,
"I'll never get old."
"You're already old," I tell him. He swivels around, and peers at me huddled in my chair.
You're scary, he goes. You know that?
It's the freckles, I go.
It's not the freckles. It's you.
He keeps looking at me, and then something shifts in his face, and he goes,
I like it.
Do not.
I do. You're gonna keep me honest, Rhea.
I'm surprised he remembers my name. I go,
it's too late for that, Lou.
Now he laughs, really laughs, and I understand that we're friends, Lou and I, even if I hate him, which I do. I get out of my chair and come to the railing where he is.
People will try to change you, Rhea. Lou goes, don't let them.
But I want to change.
No, he goes, serious. You're beautiful. Stay like this.
But the freckles, I go, and my throat gets that ache.
The freckles are the best part, Lou says. Some guy is gonna go apeshit for those freckles. He's gonna kiss them one by one.
I start to cry. I don't even hide it.
Hey, Lou goes.
He leans down so our faces are together and stares straight into my eyes. He looks tired, like someone walked on his skin and left footprints. He goes,
the world is full of shitheads, Rhea. Don't listen to them. Listen to me.
And I know that Lou is one of those shitheads. But I listen. 2 weeks after that night, Jocelyn runs away. I find out with everyone else. Her mother comes straight to my house. She and my parents and older brother sit me down. What do I know? Who is this new boyfriend? I tell them Lou. He lives in LA and has 6 children. He knows Bill Graham personally. I think Benny might know who Lou actually is, so Jocelyn's mom comes to our school to talk with Benny Salazar, but he's hard to find. Now that Alice and Scotty are together, Benny has stopped completely coming to the pit. He and Scotty still don't talk, but before they were like one person. Now it's like they've never met. I can't stop wondering. If I'd pulled away from Lou and fought the garbage throwers, would Benny have settled for me like Scotty settled for Alice? Could that one thing have made all the difference? They track down Lou in a matter of days. He tells Jocelyn's mom that she hitchhiked all the way to his house without even warning him. He says she's safe. He's taking care of her. It's better than having her on the street. Lou promises to bring her back when he comes to the city the next week. Why not this week, I wonder. While I'm waiting for Jocelyn, Alice invites me over. We take the bus from school, a long ride to Seacliff. Her house looks smaller in daylight. In the kitchen, we mix honey with her mother's homemade yogurts and eat 2 each. We go up to her room, where all the frogs are, and sit on her built-in window seat. Alice tells me she's planning to get real frogs and keep them in a terrarium. She's calm and happy now that Scotty loves her. I can't tell if she's actually real, or if she's stopped caring if she's real or not. Or is not caring what makes a person real? I wonder if Lou's house is near the ocean. Does Jocelyn look at the waves? Do they ever leave Lou's bedroom? Is Rolf there? I keep getting lost in these questions. Then I hear giggling, pounding from somewhere. I go, who's that? My sisters, Alice goes. They're playing tetherball. We trip downstairs and outside into Alice's backyard, where I've only been in the dark. It's sunny now, with flowers and patterns, and a tree with lemons on it. At the edge of the yard, 2 little girls are slapping a bright yellow ball around a silver pole. They turn to us, laughing in their green uniforms. Chapter 4 Safari 1. Grass. Remember, Charlie, in Hawaii, when we went to the beach at night and it started to rain?
Rolf is talking to his older sister, Charlene, who despises her real name. But because they're crouched around a bonfire with the other people on the safari, and because Rolf doesn't speak up all that often, and because their father, Lou, sitting behind them on a camp chair, as they draw in the dust with little sticks, is a record producer whose personal life is of general interest, those near enough to hear are listening closely. Remember how Mom and Dad stayed at the table for one more drink?
Impossible,
their father interjects, with a wink at the bird-watching ladies to his left. Both women wear binoculars, even in the dark, as if hoping to spot birds in the firelit tree overhead. Remember, Charlie, how the beach was still warm and that crazy wind was blowing? But Charlie is focused on her father's legs, which have intertwined behind her with those of his girlfriend, Mindy. Soon they will bid the group goodnight and retreat to their tent, where they'll make love on one of the narrow, rickety cots inside it, or possibly on the ground. From the adjacent tent she and Rolf share, Charlie can hear them. Not sounds, exactly, but movement. Rolf is too young to notice. Charlie throws back her head, startling her father. Lou is in his late 30s, square-jawed surfer's face, gone a little draggy under the eyes. You were married to Mom on that trip, she informs him, her voice distorted by the arching of her neck, which is encircled by a puka shell choker.
Yes, Charlie, Lou says, I'm aware of that.
The elderly bird-watching ladies trade a sad smile. Lou is one of those men whose restless charm has generated a contrail of personal upheaval that is practically visible behind him. Two failed marriages, and two more kids back home in L.A. who were too young to bring on this three-week safari. The safari is a new business venture of Lou's old army buddy, Ramsey, with whom he drank and misbehaved, having barely avoided Korea almost 20 years ago. Rolf pulls at his sister's shoulder. He wants her to remember, to feel it all again. The wind, the endless black ocean, the two of them peering into the dark as if awaiting a signal from their distant, grown-up lives. Remember, Charlie? Yeah, Charlie says, narrowing her eyes. I do remember that. The Samburu warriors have arrived, four of them, two holding drums, a child in the shadows minding a yellow longhorn cow. They came yesterday, too, after the morning game run, when Lou and Mindy were napping. That's when Charlie exchanged shy glances with the most beautiful warrior, who has scar tissue designs coiled like railroad tracks over the rigorous architecture of his chest and shoulders and back. Charlie stands up and moves closer to the warriors. A skinny girl in shorts and a raw cotton shirt with small round buttons made of wood. Her teeth are slightly crooked. When the drummers pat their drums, Charlie's warrior and the other one begin to sing, guttural noises pried from their abdomens. She sways in front of them. During her 10 days in Africa, she has begun to act like a different sort of girl, the sort that intimidates her back home. In a cinder block town they visited a few days ago, she drank a muddy-looking concoction in a bar and wound up trading away her silver butterfly earrings, a birthday gift from her father, in a hut belonging to a very young woman whose breasts were leaking milk. She was late returning to the jeeps. Albert, who works for Ramsey, had to go and find her. Prepare yourself, he warned. Your dad is having kittens. Charlie didn't care and doesn't now. There's a charge for her in simply commanding the fickle beam of her father's attention, feeling his disquiet as she dances, alone, by the fire. Lou lets go of Mindy's hand and sits up straight. He wants to grab his daughter's skinny arm and yank her away from these black men, but does no such thing, of course. That would be letting her win. The warrior smiles at Charlie. He's 19. Only 5 years older than she is, and has lived away from his village since he was 10. But he's sung for enough American tourists to recognize that in her world, Charlie is a child. 35 years from now, in 2008, This warrior will be caught in the tribal violence between the Kikuyu and the Luo and will die in a fire. He'll have had 4 wives and 63 grandchildren by then, one of whom, a boy named Joe, will inherit his lalama, the iron hunting dagger in a leather scabbard now hanging at his side. Joe will go to college at Columbia and study engineering, becoming an expert in visual robotic technology that detects the slightest hint of irregular movement, the legacy of a childhood spent scanning the grass for lions. He'll marry an American named Lulu and remain in New York, where he'll invent a scanning device that becomes standard issue for crowd security. He and Lulu will buy a loft in Tribeca, where his grandfather's hunting dagger will be displayed inside a cube of plexiglass, directly under a skylight.
"Son," Lou says, into Rolf's ear, "let's take a walk."
The boy rises from the dust and walks with his father away from the fire. 12 tents, each sleeping 2 safari guests, make a circle around it, along with 3 outhouses and a shower stall, where water warmed on the fire is released from a sack with a rope bowl. Out of view, near the kitchen, are some smaller tents for the staff, and then the black, muttering expanse of the bush, where they've been cautioned never to go.
"Your sister's acting nuts," Lou says, striding into the dark.
"Why?" Rolf asks. He hasn't noticed anything nutty in Charlie's behavior. But his father hears the question differently.
"Women are crazy," he says. "You could spend a goddamn lifetime trying to figure out why."
"Mom's not." "True," Lou reflects, calmer now.
"In fact, your mother's not crazy enough."
The singing and drum beats fall suddenly away, leaving Lou and Rolf alone under a sharp moon. "What about Mindy?" Rolf asks. "Is she crazy?"
"Good question," Lou says. "What do you think?"
"She likes to read. She brought a lot of books."
"Did she?"
"I like her," Rolf says, "but I don't know if she's crazy or what the right amount is." Lou puts his arm around Rolf. If he were an introspective man, he would have understood years ago that his son is the one person in the world with the power to soothe him. And that, while he expects Rolf to be like him, what he most enjoys in his son are the many ways he's different, quiet, reflective, attuned to the natural world and the pain of others.
"Who cares?" Lou says. "Right?"
"Right," Rolf agrees, and the women fall away like those drum beats, leaving him and his father together, an invincible unit. At 11 years old, Rolf knows 2 clear things about himself. He belongs to his father, and his father belongs to him. They stand still, surrounded by the whispering bush. The sky is crammed with stars. Rolf closes his eyes and opens them again. He's in Africa with his father. He thinks, "I'll remember this night for the rest of my life." And he's right. When they finally return to camp, the warriors have gone. Only a few diehards from the Phoenix faction, as Lou calls the safari members who hail from that dubious place, still sit by the fire, comparing the day's animal sightings. Rolf creeps into his tent, pulls off his pants, and climbs onto his cot in a t-shirt and underwear. He assumes that Charlie is asleep. When she speaks, he can hear in her voice that she's been crying. "Where did you go?" she says. 2. Hills.
"What on earth have you got in that backpack?"
It's Cora, Lou's travel agent. She hates Mindy, but Mindy doesn't take it personally. It's structural hatred, a term she coined herself and is finding highly useful on this trip. A single woman in her 40s who wears high-collared shirts to conceal the thready sinews of her neck will structurally despise the 23-year-old girlfriend of a powerful male who not only employs said middle-aged female, but is paying her way on this trip. "Anthropology books," she tells Cora. "I'm in the PhD program at Berkeley."
"Why don't you read them?"
Car sick, Mindy says, which is plausible, God knows, in the shuddering jeeps, though untrue. She isn't sure why she hasn't cracked her Boaz or Malinowski or Julian Jaynes, but assumes she must be learning in other ways that will prove equally fruitful. In bold moments, fueled by the boiled black coffee they serve each morning in the meal tent, Mindy has even wondered if her insights on the link between social structure and emotional response could amount to more than a rehash of Levi Strauss, a refinement, a contemporary application. She's only in her second year of coursework. Their Jeep is last in a line of five, nosing along a dirt road through grassland whose apparent brown masks a wide internal spectrum of color. Purples, greens, reds. Albert, the surly Englishman who is Ramsay's second in command, is driving. Mindy has managed to avoid Albert's Jeep for several days, but he's developed a reputation for discovering the best animals, so although there's no game run today, they're relocating to the hills where they'll spend the night in a hotel for the first time this trip, the children beg to ride with him. And keeping Lou's children happy, or as close to happy as is structurally possible, is part of Mindy's job. Structural resentment. The adolescent daughter of a twice-divorced male will be unable to tolerate the presence of his new girlfriend, and will do everything in her limited power to distract him from said girlfriend's presence, her own nascent sexuality being her chief weapon. Structural affection. A twice-divorced male's pre-adolescent son, and favorite child, will embrace and accept his father's new girlfriend because he hasn't yet learned to separate his father's loves and desires from his own. In a sense, he too will love and desire her, and she will feel maternal toward him, though she isn't old enough to be his mother. Lou opens the large aluminum case where his new camera is partitioned in its foam padding like a dismantled rifle. He uses the camera to stave off the boredom that afflicts him when he can't physically move around. He's rigged a tiny cassette player.